Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program today is UNICEF CauseTech, Crowdsourcing Global Innovation for Good. Our speakers are Shahad Sapra, MD, Director of UNICEF Global Innovation Center, Lisa Nash, Chief Marketing Officer, Thrive Networks, CEO, Blue Planet Network, and Wayne Ferreira, CEO of Ecola Blue. Our moderator for today, who I'll be turning the program over to now, is Donovan Neil May. Donovan is the Executive Director of the Chief Marketing Officer Council and also the Executive Director of the Business Performance Innovation Network, who are part of the hosting program for today. With that, I'd like you to ask you to please welcome Donovan Neil May.
Thank you, Kevin, and thanks to our guests. I'm glad to be here hosting this program. We have some exciting perspectives to convey to you. First of all, I think we need to know a little bit about UNICEF today, its sphere of operation worldwide, and why on earth is UNICEF getting into the innovation business with its innovation labs around the world. And Dr. Sapra here has traveled far to get here. He's based in Nairobi. And his other leadership team is also based in far-flung places, Bangkok, to name a few, and, of course, New York. But, Dr. Sapra, could you answer that question relative to what is UNICEF's mission today? Has it changed? What are the dynamics in the field that you're having to deal with?
Right. UNICEF's mission is and has always been children. The mission has not changed. But how do we achieve results for children is changing dramatically, especially with the dawn of the new era of technology. Now, the reason why innovation is critical for achieving results for children worldwide is because our mission is to reach every child. And what has happened in the last three or four decades is as a result of some very successful strategies. We've been able to take services and results for the few. So you had, let's say, immunization coverage only 20%, 25% worldwide, to many. So now the immunization rates are more than 75%. We had a disparity in the enrollment of girls all over the world. And now there is parity in enrollment of girls. So a lot of success. But then with success, the assumptions that we actually started with to create these strategies, all those assumptions have changed. We started with the assumption that health workers are not there. Now the health workers are there. We started with the assumption girls don't go to school. Now they go to school. But there's still about 20% odd left who are outside or who have not benefited from these results, or from the expansion of services or introduction of new interventions. And to reach them, the existing strategies are no longer enough. They are good, but not enough. And therefore, the way to reach them would be to find new and innovative ways of doing business. Plus also, technology is a big game changer. It has leveled the playing field between the rich and the poor by just being able to connect and talk to the markets, to the schools, to the health workers and the health system. And so what we want to do is tap into these changing or evolving technologies and see how we can actually deploy them for the benefit of children and women all over the world.
So you have teamed with my organizations to set up a destination on the web called CauseTech.net. It's a global community. It's a portal that will showcase innovation that you are invested in. It'll also invite people to submit ideas, as well as to participate in voting and perhaps graduating ideas up to reality. So what is this initiative, and what's the who are you targeting here with this new online venture?
Right. So we live, eat, breathe children. Not eat children. But basically, that is our life. How do we bring results to children? We're not a technology company. We are not a venture capitalist. We are not logistics or distribution people. We do a little bit of all of that, but that's really not our core work. But here in Silicon Valley, and what we hope is with CauseNet, we actually can link the needs of the field with the venture capitalists, the value chain that exists at all levels in Silicon Valley. We work in about 150 countries. We've been there for 67 years. We've been there before the cameras came. We have been there when the cameras were there, and we are there after the cameras have left. We have more than 11,000 people on the ground, which means that we live with the community. We work with the community. We work horizontally and vertically. And so we kind of are a part of the community. So it's, and we are at the base of the pyramid. So we are able to take the base of the pyramid and the needs from there and connect it to the top of the pyramid, which is out here, try to bridge the gap and use the skill sets and the resources and the capacities that exist here. And we hope that COSNET is the platform that brings in the two parts of the world together for mutual success.
So clearly one of the biggest areas of need is clean drinking water and access to water in general amongst disadvantaged audiences. Lisa, you are the CEO of Blue Planet Network, and could you tell us a little bit about what you see as the challenge and the need out there relative to that issue?
Sure, and great to be here tonight. As Donovan said, Blue Planet Network is a global community of water and sanitation organizations, 112 organizations operating in 27 countries around the world. So while UNICEF is a tremendous organization everywhere, Blue Planet Network has a different concept. We go out and find outstanding organizations on the ground and connect them, because our belief is there is so much tremendous knowledge out in the field that is just locked up. There's a great idea in Nicaragua that could be used in Uganda. There's a great technique in Vietnam that should be used in California. How do you get that information out? That's the beauty of the internet. The internet was designed to connect and to educate people. So we give our members around the world an online platform to share their knowledge about water and sanitation and then track their programs, because they're all fantastic at delivering water, working with the community on sanitation, but they may not be as good as the people in the Bay Area at how do you use technology to optimize results. So that's where we come in, and we love to partner with organizations like UNICEF so that we can share the knowledge of our members so that more and more people get safe drinking water, because most of the problems are either in the urban slums or they're out in the middle of remote places. And both of those require very different solutions, and we hope to bring some of that to the table.
So one of the innovations that's come to my attention, at least, comes from a South African expat who now is based in Silicon Valley, and he runs a company called Ecolo Blue. He also happens to be, in his day, probably one of the best tennis players in the world. I think he probably still has a very strong forehand. But, Wayne Ferreira is, I think, took much of his winnings from tennis and put him into this new venture. Can you tell us a little bit about exactly how are you making water from air?
Yeah, I mean, originally what happened was is that I was in South Africa and I was involved in a project in a very low-income development who had run out of water. And they were trying to find ways of bringing water to them. And literally we couldn't come up with any solutions. I did a lot of research, came up with this technology called atmospheric water generation, which is basically taking the humidity out of the air. For a similar concept, it's like a dehumidifier, but the opposite. Dehumidifier is able to take the humidity out of the air. We, in the other sense, have to make as much water as we can out of the least amount of humidity in the air. And I came across this concept. I really believe it's the future for water. We're having big struggles trying to find water in underground aquifers. The rain's not coming. There's just not a lot of options out there. And I strongly believe that the atmosphere has what we need to supply water to everybody. So I set forward to try to produce a machine that could make the water out of the humidity, which we have done. We've been very successful in producing small-scale to large-scale production. We have a small unit that makes up to 8 gallons a day. We have a large unit that makes 2,500 gallons a day. And we've done very well on getting that out. The issue that we have right now, and this is why my involvement with CauseTech is to come up with new ideas to make it cost-effective. At the moment, it's a little bit too expensive for the masses. My idea for this project in South Africa was to get free water. And at this moment, it's a great way of making water, but it's not free yet. And our goal is to spend as much time and energy on trying to get innovative ways to reduce the energies, which are improving drastically at the moment with new ideas with hydrogen, hydro, all kinds of other concepts that we believe that we will be able to get this machine to run if on its own, independently, and produce ultimately free water. And this is why I'm trying to work with CauseTech and work with innovative ideas to try to see if we can come up with a solution with this type of technology.
So the idea of crowdsourcing innovation has happened because there are now platforms like IdeaScale, which we are using, that allows participation globally in the process of taking, let's say, his product idea, which is already commercially viable, but is not necessarily socially viable. So how do we then find people with ideas to either be an energy source that might be hybrid, solar power, wind power, but how do you power that particular system that he has at a rate that's sustainable and self-sufficient? So in those cases, Dr. Sapra, can you tell us how does it work with CauseTech? What typically will happen? His idea is already up there in the inspirations area of the site. Now we're going to. How do you go forward with trying to solicit interest and ideas?
So we believe that every challenge that we face in the world, someone has found the answer. We just need to find that person or that company, and I think CauseTech would allow us to bring the challenges, but also connect it with the answers that are already there. I mean, imagine the number of intellectual property registrations or IPs that never saw the commercialization because they were not commercially viable. But who knows? They might have a social value. And how can we tap into those? The people, when they will join CauseTech, would not only be able to understand the needs and how their solutions could work from the needs, but actually we start a conversation and an exchange of ideas that we believe can actually make a major difference. And that's why we think the idea of CauseTech is useful for us.
So this whole notion of inspirations overcoming limitations, and the campaign you call Succeed Where There's a Need, Your Brilliance Can Make a Difference, is all compelling. But you at UNICEF, yourselves within your own innovation lab network, are doing some pretty amazing stuff. Could you tell us a little bit about some of that? Diagnostics and mobile interactions with youth at risk around the world?
Yeah. As I said in the beginning, the mobile phone technology is a big game changer. And with penetration rates of over 70% in Africa and other developing countries in Asia and the Pacific, it gives us a very good tool to actually engage young people. I mean, if we take the definition of democracy, of the people, by the people, for the people, a large amount of work that has been done in the development field and humanitarian field is for the people. Why? Because there were very few tools available where we could actually engage a large number of people, which would be by the people and of the people, developed ideas developed by the people themselves, by the users themselves. And then you put science and technology behind it, which rests in places like this, and then make them scalable. So we worked on things where, right now, we have something called U-Report, which is a simple SMS-based tool, which over 800,000 users in 16 countries where we are. And then twice a week, we have opinion polls. with the young people. And the reason why it is important to have their opinion taken and then used to influence policy and decision-making is because these young people, most of them have gone through school. And the promise made to them was education equals employment. That is not happening. A large part of the growth is jobless growth that is happening. And so these people feel very frustrated, angry, feel that no one listens to them, no one cares about them, their voice doesn't matter, and they're angry, frustrated, and very vulnerable, which means that anyone with vested interest can exploit them. And we're seeing that, ISIS, we're seeing unrest in many other countries. Even here, sometimes a small incident actually triggers a whole series of riots, and that's not necessarily linked to that incident, but it's all that anger, pent-up anger that is there that comes out. So your report, as we call this tool, actually allows young people to share their opinion and then influence decision-making, policy, legislation in countries. So in Uganda, every single parliamentarian is now on your report. And then 250,000 young people twice a week are constantly talking and sharing their views, which are aggregated, put on the television, put on the radio, published in the newspaper. And what has happened is that now many parliamentarians in Uganda are actually connected to their constituency, and they are asking the young people about their opinion before they go and speak in the parliament or vote on a bill. And it's that kind of power, that kind of engagement that will turn the whole thing around, where young people and this generation is not going to be passive recipients of services, but would actually be engaged as owners of those services and as influencers of those services. So that's one of the ideas. But we have working with the Rhodes University in South Africa, we're trying to develop remote diagnosis. Many of the rural areas don't have doctors. So what we are hoping to do is develop paper-based, paper strip-based diagnostic techniques that would allow the diagnosis to be done on the spot itself within 10, 15 minutes and totally change the quality of care.
Excellent. So, Lisa, you know, you've been doing, you've been on your mission for quite some time. How receptive is your constituency to really sharing ideas, exchanging ideas? I mean, this whole issue of knowledge transfer, mm-hmm. How do you go about precipitating that and getting people to collaborate and to break down those silos of, you know, people tend to want to be withhold their information. So you're operating globally. What have you done to try to use the web to get more coordination and collaboration?
Well, those are great questions, because even in the nonprofit world where we operate, organizations around the world want to collaborate, but they all have to get the grants to be able to do their work, and so there's a potential for a lot of conflict and confusion. But what we did back in 2006 when we launched our platform is we went to 5 organizations around the world who were known for their work, had been successful, they were in-country water and sanitation organizations, and they were also very comfortable in their own skin. You know, they really wanted to learn, and they knew that they couldn't learn if they didn't share. So when we launched the platform, we invited them to come on, and they really became like a peer group to each other. So whenever one of the organizations had a new project plan, they put it on the platform, and some of the other organizations would have an exchange with them of questions and answers. Have you thought about this? We tried that. It didn't work. What about you? The end result was the organization with the project plan got a better project plan that was more successful, and all the other organizations that had peer-reviewed that plan learned something in the process of conversation. So while many organizations sort of looked at it and said, do I really want to share mistakes? Do I really want to share whatever I'm doing that's really successful? Once they started it, they couldn't stop, because it really became like a global community where they could help each other and see the benefit to themselves as well. So while you were just talking about helping youth and helping people get better individually, we're helping organizations that then help communities. But the idea of engaging communities is just as important. And I'm sure with the work that you're doing with taking the water out of the air, you've got to have community engagement as well. So what we're working on now is how to get those actual end communities on our platform. Because at the end of the day, we believe in a couple of things. Number one, there has to be accountability and transparency. So all the information, all the plans have to be there. So if any one of you are thinking of donating to a water project, you should be able to go on your computer in San Francisco and see what's happening in Kenya. There's absolutely no reason why you can't. And then if you do that, you will get to learn more and you will bring good ideas. So just like CauseTech is doing this, we're trying to do it in our own small way within our community, because the more you get people to collaborate, the more they see the value and the more they add. So it's a virtuous circle.
Being an entrepreneur is no easy task. So one last question to Wayne. What do you think has been the biggest trials and tribulations you've faced in getting governments or communities to really realize the potential of your product? I mean, it strikes me it's not just the delivery of clean drinking water in far-flung places, but also potentially micro-enterprise.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a struggle in a lot of different ways. The awareness of the product has obviously been very difficult. People do kind of grasp the concept of what it is that we do, but people haven't seen it around, and they like to follow trends a little bit. We've been doing a lot of work with local municipalities and government, and that in all big pictures is always difficult to do. The one issue that we have, which I find very unusual, is that because atmospheric water generators is not classified in their book that was put out probably 30, 40 years ago, they're not willing to actually open it up and put a new one in the book. So we have a lot of issues to fight with trying to get this type of technology recognized as a viable solution. There's a lot of things like that. So the difficulties are it, but, you know, we've been fighting hard. These things take time. We believe that we will be successful in it. It's just a battle that you have to fight. So there's been difficulties on that, but it's worth the struggle because it has a lot of value in the end.
Strikes me that a partnership with UNICEF would open a lot of doors. So maybe could you comment, Dr. Sapra, a little bit on what makes UNICEF distinctive as a, let's say, as a go-to-market partner for somebody who's got social technology that they want to actually see implemented?
Well, it's, as I said, 67 years on the ground in 150 countries, over 11,000 people. We are a part of that system. We are an intergovernmental organization. We work with the government all the time. We work with NGOs. We work with the community. So it opens up and removes a lot of barriers, opens up doors, because there is the trust and the credibility that UNICEF has as an organization. It's considered as, it is non-political. And we don't pass judgments on people. We actually try to work from within and change the system rather than take the high road and point fingers at people. So it really allows people to work with us. And then, for instance, you mentioned, Wayne, about putting that in a school book. We work in all the countries revising curriculum. Mm-hmm. So stuff like that is easy for us. And therefore, taking that credibility from the ground and then bringing in entrepreneurs, bringing in networks like your network, It is a win-win for everyone.
Absolutely. What sort of challenges do you face, you know, operationally that you're trying to solve? And I think some of that you're doing with logistics and supply chains and, monitoring of your supplies and your medications and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it seems to me a vast undertaking for your budget is somewhere around $4.5 billion, and it's big.
Well, it's $4.5 billion thanks to you all who contribute to UNICEF, because UNICEF doesn't get a single penny from the UN. It is all money that's raised from the public and from the governments. And for instance, if you want to know about work of UNICEF or contribute to UNICEF in USA, it's unicefusa.org. you can contribute there, and that's what makes the $5 billion. It's every penny and every, because it's not just the money that you put in; it is the confidence that you put in that really makes a difference. The big on the technology side, the big challenges that we face are about connectivity and energy. Those are the two big areas. But for instance, right now in Nepal, we have got about 200 people on the ground, and not that we flew them in, they were there. But the biggest challenge is, how do you reach remote areas? How do you connect with people in those remote areas to get the information of what the needs are? So we're working with satellite companies here in Silicon Valley and with NASA, connecting them to local communities to actually get that image. But if the connectivity is not there or the energy is not there to power the cell phones, a lot of that thing is not going to work. Drones. I mean, Amazon is delivering packages. Imagine in a place like Nepal with all the roads broken down, groups like Amazon or others could actually be delivering humanitarian supplies. And you know, the first few days are critical. After that, it's all about maintenance. So there are many challenges, but really none of them deter us from getting what we need to do. In Afghanistan, when I was working, this is 2002, the bombing was still going on, Taliban was still around or moving out. I had 6,500 donkeys actually deliver my supplies, you know. So, yes, things we face challenges, but nothing that is cannot be overcome. But life would be a lot easier if partners on COSTECH can actually come and provide us solutions to some of these problems.
So this question came up, I think, at one of your appearances this week, but you've been at UNICEF for some 29 years or more, and
yes.
you're actually a doctor who's never written a prescription. Tell us about the most gratifying moments that you've had working with UNICEF in many different capacities.
You see, for I don't speak about myself only, but I speak for every UNICEF person. I mean, I know almost every one of them in the last 29 years. But to give you an example, the look in the eye of the mother whose child has just been saved or demobilized, or the look in the eye of the child who was a child soldier and has just been demobilized, or the sound of water coming to an area which for 33 years didn't have any water. That is what makes us tick. That is what makes our life worth it, and all the hard work that people of UNICEF put in worth it.
Is it hard to recruit field workers to UNICEF? I mean, what does it take to be a real contributor outside of great sacrifice?
No, if you look at UNICEF and the people who work in UNICEF, almost all of them, for us, UNICEF is not a job. It's a commitment. And UNICEF allows, like, I have changed 15 different job descriptions during these 29 years. It's like having 15 different jobs without changing the organization. UNICEF allows you to align your passion with your work. And when that happens, everything falls into place.
Excellent. I think we want to try to get some questions from the audience.
Great. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is UNICEF COSTECH, Crowdsourcing Global Innovation for Good, with Dr. Sharad Sapra, Lisa Nash, Wayne Ferreira, and Donovan Neil May. I would like to turn it over now for audience questions, and please make sure you do speak into the microphone.
Hello, my name is Nicole. I have a question specifically about your water product. I know that obviously the free market, it's easier for new technology to kind of come to fruition. But in your situation, what action in specific has helped you kind of overcome the obstacles that government funding or grant funding, what has kind of been the main breakthrough action to help get your product to market when it comes to those areas?
Most of the areas or the places we've been selling water are for places who are desperate for water. That for us right now is the best place for us to be. We're still our company's been going for 8 years now, and we still feel that we're in the infancy stage. I mean, my goal when I set up the company was to be able to provide free water. We have a machine now that makes water and does a very good job at that, but still costs money on the electrical side. We're working on new developments to reduce the energies. We're working on different technologies to make it smaller and bigger. So at the moment, we're selling to places who need the water. We have countries in Middle East, Africa, South America, Central America, the Caribbean. I mean, there's a lot of places that are desperate for water. But ultimately, our goal is to get it to everybody. So we're working on a long-term goal of providing free water. But at the moment, you know, they're easier to deal with the countries who are really desperate for water. It's much easier to provide to them.
Thank you very much for the information. My name is Atar Gandewal with Afghan Impact Alliance. And the question about Afghanistan, the EU report, is there any work done in that area? Because Afghanistan and its youth can really use it. So I'm wondering if you can elaborate on
that. Well, I worked for 2.5 years in Afghanistan. And I don't know if you're familiar with Back to School campaign, where in 60 days, UNICEF got 3 million children into school. I happened to have the privilege to lead that. And then after that, I actually worked for 2 more years in Afghanistan. So while your report is not there, but what is there is called EduTrack, where the education system has taken the same principle and actually has schools reporting on teacher attendance, availability of textbooks, whether the toilet is working or not, the water is working or not. And then that information is triangulated by school management committees replying to the same thing. And then young people themselves also contributing to the same. And in Asia, Afghanistan is the place which is showing way to other countries like India and Pakistan and others on how to use that tool to actually improve the reporting, which is not inspectorial from top down, but from the community up.
Absolutely.
I have a question again about the water project, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your energy issues. Specifically, is this a battery issue? And what sort of batteries are you thinking about working with? Because I know, since this may or may not be on the radio, a lot of people in Silicon Valley work with batteries for our startups and different companies. You might find what you need. Thanks.
Yeah, batteries are obviously a huge industry that can be very productive for machineries and renewable energies. So batteries are important. But, you know, with the battery, you need the energy. And we're working with some renewables. You obviously have the wind and the solar. We're doing a lot of work now with hydrogen power and hydropower. With our machine making water, hydro is quite a good solution. It's just difficult to make it in a closed loop system where the water that's made can be used to create the energy as well. There's also turbines that can be used on our machines. Our machines suck the air in and blow the air out the back of the machine. So there's a 7 meter per second wind that's getting blown out the back that can be designed with a wind turbine. So there's a lot of different ways that we can work around different renewables to obviously drop the electricity. But once we drop the electricity, it does always come back to where do you store it. And that's where the battery becomes extremely important.
This question is for Dr. Chopra. I came to San Francisco because of my skills in artificial intelligence. And if you could give me some ideas of the applications for natural language processing, it seems like the sharing information is what I heard as being helpful, but the language barrier is likely there. That, and then also a second part, my job is also in automating things, and so your reflections on the challenges of joblessness, because one of my tasks is to automate what people do.
Right. So the first question on machine learning, that is an extremely important part, especially because when you're successful and these 800,000 people are interacting with you and then getting a feedback and seeing things change, then they actually start trusting you. And one of the problems of success is that they start sending you unsolicited messages about things that are not working in their area. And which essentially then means if you're in Nigeria, you're dealing with 14 languages. In Uganda, you're dealing with 7 languages. So we started work with IBM Research Lab and their classifier with Watson. And that worked well for Uganda, but it's not an open source technology. So which essentially means that all the data has to go there and they process it. But if others want to use it, it's not available. So now we're working with 2 companies, plus Qatar Foundation, to actually see how, and we're going to start machine learning trials in Nigeria and in Burundi. Burundi, we'll have to rethink now with the crisis going on. But basically, the idea is how successful machine language would be in actually taking this information, learning, because there's tons of data. So the learning part is not the difficult part. But how do we then classify it? And then, so that trial is now starting. But as I said, Costech, if you have the expertise in that area, nothing would be more powerful to be used on a large global scale than a good machine learning program. So thank you for asking that question. And hopefully you would support us in actually developing technology which can be used. The second was the issue of automation. And the resultant jobs not being there. The problem is not so much about automation. The problem comes because the people who are left out totally are in rural areas, remote areas, and a lot of their market share is lost because of transportation. And there are not many easy ways of transporting goods without increasing the cost. But what we have found is that when you talk of automation and transportation, I put that in, you guys have put a vehicle on the Mars and on the Moon, right? And we are not able to move our pregnant women on Earth from 5 kilometers because of the terrain. And that is the kind of kids going to school. Normally you have to walk about 5 or 6 kilometers each way. And during that path, they are not only do they get tired by the time they reach the school, but they are vulnerable to be exploited and abused or trafficked. What are the innovative transport solutions and automated solutions which actually create more jobs? And that is where the key would be. How do you get these young people who are educated? But, you know, today, if you pass your secondary school, you have zilch, not one employable skill, right? The only thing you know is history and geography, and God knows whose history and whose geography. Poetry, maybe, English grammar. But vocation, which is one of the key things to employability, it doesn't exist. And so people have to then enroll in another school for 2 years before they can acquire any skill. So anything that helps in this area is going to make a dramatic difference. So you are critical to our success on the ground.
Welcome to the team.
Good evening. My name is FJ, and I work for a social enterprise enabling consulting firm named Kava Consulting. My question is actually for Lisa, Blue Planet Network, and I was very interested because I deal with some of the same challenges you have overcome, which is people sharing. The thing that you said you had a network of people who had proposals, and then they shared and gave feedback. How did you build the trust in the beginning for people to share what people consider proprietary information? Both, even on the nonprofit side, as you said, competition is fierce. And I have the same issues on the social enterprise side. People think there is the most innovative. I can't share with anybody. Signed an NDA. So it fascinates me that you cracked that nut in order that people are comfortable enough to share without feeling threatened by that sharing. Thank you.
Well, we're just, number one, very lucky that our members are who they are, because, as I said, they're comfortable in their skin. They have achieved a level of success. And I think the way that we've helped them share particularly the difficulties is by helping them package it. So one of my favorite stories is very simple. There was an organization in India, and they'd put a well in and a cistern cover. And a bull had walked into town and had dirtied the well, I guess is the best way to put it. And so obviously people couldn't drink the water. And one of the rules of being a member of the community is you have to do regular updates. And so they emailed me and said, we can't say this has happened. Everyone will see it. And all of our donors will see that it's terrible, and the people in the next village will know. But what we said to them is, first, fix the problem. That's the most important thing. And then put up a case study that says, 2 weeks ago, this bull came into town and dirtied our well. And here's what we did about it. You know, we added a lock to the cover. We did nothing that's terribly high tech, but put it out so that you then look as if you know what you're doing, you're happy to share, and it shows you are expert. They did that, and immediately 5 donors found them and wanted to give them more money for other water projects because they know. Stuff happens all the time, and everyone realizes this. But this organization was able to demonstrate how they were able to deal with the difficulties. So my background is in marketing. So there's a little bit of helping people understand how to package and present information. And it really helped people understand the difficulties on the ground and how to really make it work.
Hi, my name is Cliff Block, currently involved with utilizing the Internet for health behavior change. But for many years, I headed a small part of USAID's research and development program, and particularly using communications for health and education. I think what you're doing is wonderful. It's great. The question that I have, though, is what methods are you using to engage country decision makers and those people who determine budgets in developing countries to continue the kind and expand the kinds of successful approaches that you've developed?
So it's all about positioning and marketing. So basically, on the budgeting and legislation and other things, normally, organizations would target the Ministry of Finance and work with Ministry of Finance. But guess what? The decisions are not made by Ministry of Finance. They're made in the Parliament. And so what we decided was to target the parliamentarians. And every parliamentarian is actually looking for the vote bank. And for instance, in Uganda, 55% of the population is young people below 35. So with your report, we actually developed enough momentum to show to the parliamentarians that people actually vote. To give you an example, the head of the state asked for $1 billion in supplementary defense budget. The young people saying, hey, there is no vaccine here. The bill was sent back 3 times, and they said, till you put $30 million for the vaccine, your supplementary defense budget will not be approved. And this was all parties. So it was not like the ruling party was divided and the others, because their vote bank was saying, we need this money, and if this money is not there, don't come back to us for the next election. And then we actually, so this was one side of it. On the other side of it, we actually told the parliamentarians, you guys don't have time actually to go back to your community as often as you would want to. Here is what we'll do. We'll connect you and create town hall meetings between you and your... So it's like creating Google Hangouts on SMS.
Exactly.
Basically. So when they see the value in these systems, they start actually not only using those systems, but they actually demand for those systems. I'll give you a very quick example. Rio, the conference, environment conference, two EU reporters ended up as official government delegates. Whatever discussions were happening, they were actually texting it back. We were rebroadcasting it in the country. And then 50 to 60,000 Ugandans were actually responding to that, which we were sending it back to them. So when Uganda spoke, basically 67,000 people spoke. And they were so influential that China and G77 actually invited the two of them. These are 20-year-old young people, to the drafting committee of the Rio. And that is where I'm told, and they say, that the line on education and environment was added to the communique.
Yeah. And I think just to add to Dr. Sharpa, what he said that was so important is that this wasn't done with smartphones. This wasn't done with fancy-dancy. This was done with the technology that people had in hand. And that is so wonderful and so powerful because then everyone gets access. So understand your customer.
I have a question. Donovan Neil May, you and the Chief Marketing Officer Council and your other organization, how are you working? The larger question here is how can business get involved with what you're doing and how can individuals follow you online to see what's happening? But Donovan, maybe if you could tell us about what you and also Sally, I'm going to ask you that question in a moment. And if you can just tell us a little bit about that, I'll hand you the mic.
Yeah, thank you. Well, our organization represents about 10,000 chief marketing officers around the world, 110 countries, not quite as many as UNICEF is in, and they control a large amount of marketing spend. Increasingly, you know, companies are seeing, you know, the millennial audiences today as being socially minded. They're looking for authentic brands. They're looking for corporate social responsibility programs. They're looking to see brands and companies participate in meaningful change. So we're seeing this linkage with UNICEF as a way for our members to potentially contribute towards contests and challenges where they can underwrite different challenges that focus specifically on, you know, real issues in the field. Many of what we see is pie-in-the-sky stuff without any sort of connection to what it's really like to deploy technology in harsh environments, to across multiple languages, in places that are difficult to reach, and to people who have a trouble, you know, interfacing with technology. So what we're trying to do is to identify members of our audience, at least of our network, the chief marketers, to come to us with funding as well as with helping us communicate. In most cases, they reach and engage many people through their social channels, through their corporate channels, through their employee channels. So we have the opportunity to activate and engage audiences. It's also something where, you know, most of these organizations are in a competitive situation when it comes to talent recruitment and retention. So these types of meaningful programs, they can get the employees behind their research departments. In many cases, some of these organizations have lost and languishing intellectual property, that, or they have R&D groups that would love to team, that have skunkworks teams that might want to do this on a voluntary basis. So there's a lot of reasons why our brands can participate, and we're hoping that they will.
Great. One of the other main organizers for bringing cause tech to California is Sally Quigley. So, Sally, if you can tell us a little bit about your organization and your role in this initiative and how it works for your organization and the benefits involved for someone else to become involved.
Sure. So I'll just clarify that it's Donovan's organization that I just manage. But I work for the Business Performance Innovation Network. We're all about innovation. And really, I've been focusing on aggregating those amazing networks that already exist, such as the Blue Planet Network, and then the technology inspirations that are out there that have the potential, and then bringing them into this network. We've built up a campaign site, causetech.net, and then we've integrated with the IdeaScale ideation platform. So that's causetech.ideascale.com, where people can start to post their ideas. We have our first contest launching June 1st, focused on alternative energy solutions for Burundi. And then we'll also have ongoing open ideation, connecting all members across the value chain. So whether that's a VC or it's another peer-powered network or it's a technology inspiration or it's another NGO. So really just bringing together all of these powerful actors to see how we can all succeed where there's a need, as our tagline says.
We have time for a few more audience questions. And while we're waiting for the audience to think about questions, I'd like to say now, as an individual, how can I or someone who hears about your cause tech and what you're doing, how can an individual follow you? Can we follow you like a sports team, or how can we best use the online platform to do that?
Yeah, so we are on Twitter, we're on LinkedIn, and it's cause tech. Cause tech is our Twitter name. And also you can find us on LinkedIn. And then, of course, just connecting and registering on our platform. So if you go to causetech.net /participate, you can get in. You can register as a guest, as an innovator, or as an expert. Part of this is really aggregating that community of mentors and experts as well, so that we can all just become a larger part of that conversation.
Okay, we have an audience in the back, audience question in the back of the room.
Hi, my name is Risa Jenkins, and I serve on the board of a couple of different social innovation funds. And one of the groups that's out there doing some interesting work is Paul Pollack's group. I always forget the name of it, but I think it's Beyond Poverty or something like that. And I'm wondering, in listening to your both network of solutions and how it is that you're working with people on the ground, I asked him the question, and I'm going to ask you the same question, is when you're developing solutions, how much of the solution that you work on is a mix and mash of what the social innovation people bring versus the people on the ground who have a tacit knowledge of solutions?
Right. So we work on 9 principles, and one of the key principles is design from the ground up and basically have the people design it. So we don't go there with technology first. We actually go with people first. And have, so when we were designing something for the health workers, it was the health workers who were saying, this is what would work for me. And this is the tool that I have. So we don't go in and plunk technology in there. We work with what they have. So many university students from US and Europe come and work with us. But we take away everything that has a chip in it and send them down to the village. And they sit with the workers for 2 weeks and with the people understand what the issues are and try to find and develop solutions using the technology that is available locally, be it low-end or be it high-end. It is only in the end when the design and interface and everything is worked out, then we say, can technology help to make it better? Otherwise not. So that is critical. And then we bring in, of course, put the science behind it and put the relevance and make sure it's robust and all, and that we do through other innovative organizations and groups like here, and bring the two together. Because one of the things is we work on fundamental core technologies or core solutions which can be used across platforms. So we don't go and say, oh, today I am creating something for left knee. We'll develop something for knee, which can actually be used in left and right and many other knees around
elbows,
the world.
Yes. Yeah, and I guess what I would add, number one, that is so important. But what we also try and do is have, beside the community designing, have our members be able to talk to other members who have been through similar situations, because obviously the community has the real knowledge and they're the customers. But then sometimes if you have other organizations, in our case water and sanitation organizations, in your case it might be something very different, who can bring their perspective and they've been through the battle, then they can actually inspire the organization and the community. And what we tend to find happens there is the community comes up with the real need and how to deliver. But by going to that second circle of people, we tend to integrate in other things. So in one case in Uganda, one of our members has a water sanitation and hygiene approach. But what another member said to them after hearing what their situation was, you know, you might want to think about trying to address clean cook stoves in the ultimate solution, because the women who you're trying to free up and give them time by having them not lug the water, if they're freed up there, they're dying because they're, you know, cooking over these terribly dirty, smoky cook stoves. So if you can do that at the same time, you're helping the environment, you're helping the women on two or three fronts, and you're helping the community be stronger. That's all the advice was. The organization that worked in Uganda took it back to the community, and they worked it through and came up with something that was probably different, but served all the issues. So it's trying to stay true to the community. You're absolutely right. But then get that second and third circle of input that has been helpful.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where we have time for only one more round of questions. I'm going to turn it back to our moderator now. And then after this last question, we would like to have each of our panelists, including our moderator, make a brief closing comment. I would like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight. Our program tonight has been UNICEF CauseTech, Crowdsourcing Global Innovation for Good, with Dr. Sharad Sapra, Lisa Nash, Wayne Ferreira, and Donovan Neil May as our moderator. And I will now hand it back to our moderator for the last round of questions.
Thank you, Kevin. So let's go to Wayne first. Where have you seen the most traction and interest in your solution? I understand you're delivering products in containers, you're delivering products standalone, but all over the world. I even understand that you've had a lot of interest here in California with the drought.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously we're starting to focus a lot on California at the moment because of the drought that's here. But initially, in the last few years, we've been doing most of our work, obviously in the Middle East. The GCC areas, they are desperate for water. Their desal is not working for them anymore. It's expensive. They're having problems running it, so our technology is becoming quite important for them. We do a lot in Africa. Africa is a little bit difficult because of the cost. You know, you have to go through government, which is sometimes very difficult. We do a lot, so we're starting to do a lot in Brazil, where they're having huge water issues. So a lot of the focus for us has been, as I mentioned earlier, about countries who are really desperate for water, you know, and that's been helpful for us to keep the company going and allow us to spend our money on R&D to keep improving the technology, because ultimately I started the company so that I could end up having the solution of having free water for everyone, and that's the goal. So we'll keep fighting and selling until we get to that stage, because I really believe that we can. But, you know, as we go along and our company grows, we realize that there's just more and more countries that are becoming more and more desperate for water, and it's just not going away. So it's, you know, it's good for us and our company, but it's quite scary to see.
Thanks. Lisa, who do you see as the leaders and the laggards in terms of taking care of delivering or preserving water and taking care of delivering safe, secure drinking water?
Well, I think one of the laggards is our own country. There is, in the United States, there's not a national policy for how do you deal with water. Water rights belong to the people who own the land. So if you're trying to really understand what you have to do, it's very, very difficult on a national basis to come up with a national strategy to help everyone. In California, there are 1 million school children who don't have access to safe drinking water when they're in school. I mean, that's a pretty crazy, crazy statistic. But there, on the good side, there's also tremendous activity going on, particularly here in California. And the fact that Wayne's technology is picking up traction here is a testimony to the people who are really trying to think of different things. I think on the other side, some of the leaders in terms of how do you get safe drinking water to people, India is a place with some of the most difficult water issues in the world, but some of the decentralization has happened to really help people at the village level come up with solutions that work for them. So you can't say India is a country because it is so vast. There are so many different regions, but we see a lot of really exciting things happening there that are going out. And also in Vietnam, You know, it's a rapidly developing country, and so they're moving between economic stages and doing some really very, very interesting things.
Dr. Sapra, you are potentially looking ahead and have a vision. What is the vision for UNICEF? What is the biggest project that you would like to see undertaken? You had touched on something with the G20. Maybe you could refer me to that.
Well, basically, we're looking at the possibility where, and it is possible now, where we can actually have hundreds of millions of lives changed and voices of hundreds of millions of people be heard at the most influential levels. Imagine a G20 meeting happening and then 100 million young people actually discussing exactly the same agenda as the G20 leaders, and all that information aggregated, feeding live into the G20 meeting, so that telling the world leaders that when you talk of peace and security, this is actually what it means to that girl trying to go to school in Afghanistan, or that mother who's trying to send a child to the school while making sure that she has enough money to bring food onto the table. So that is the kind of power where democracy from bottom up, and not once every 5 years at the election time, but from bottom up, continuous taking place. And that's the kind of vision that we are looking at. The second big thing that we are looking at is that in this day and age, it is unacceptable that the place where you are born and the economic status of your family will determine what your future is going to be like. It's totally unacceptable. Be it in this country because of student loans or the cost of education, or be it in Africa because of access or no teacher in the classroom.
Great. Well, thank you very much for each of our panelists. I would like to ask each of you in total social media style, including our moderator, to, if you could give us 140 characters there about statement for the future and what we can all do coming out of this, and then we will wrap up our program. Thank you very much all for being here. I will close with the traditional three gavels at the end. Donovan, I'm going to start with you.
I encourage you to be inspired. Go to the CourseTech.net site. Take a look at some things like how to have a bath without actually using water. Take a look at the Tower of Power, where you can actually charge battery-powered appliances, have the energy stored in your home. There's lots of exciting stuff there, and we would love to see your opinions.
Great. Wayne, how about you?
Well, I would tell everybody living in Silicon Valley or in the area that it's time for you to really put your time and energies into looking for alternate solutions for the rest of the world. People here are very complacent in the way that they live and they like what they have, but they're not really willing to put themselves out for the rest of the world. And there's a lot of money and a lot of influence and a lot of smart people who together can really come up with great ideas to help the rest of the world. And there's no better time to start now. People are feeling the brunt of the water issue here in California, and now they can start realizing what people have been suffering and how they've been suffering for a long time. So get going and start working on it and start helping the world.
Thank you, Wayne. Lisa Nash.
Well, first I would say Silicon Valley is everywhere in the globe. The capability is there. And I would also say problems do not exist because of lack of resources. They exist because of lack of resourcefulness. So that is a power and an energy we all have. Technology can help, but the resourcefulness is born within.
Dr. Jihad Sapra.
I would say that it is possible for Silicon Valley, with all the capacities, resources, and skill sets, to work with groups like UNICEF, with the knowledge of the ground, knowledge of the base of the pyramid, and the needs to actually make a difference in the lives of not tens or thousands of people, as you all already do through your philanthropy and through your charitable work, but hundreds of millions of people, and not in a decade, but in the next 4 or 5 years. It is very much possible, and we invite you to join all of us to actually make that happen.
Well, thank you to all of our panelists here today at the Commonwealth Club. I'd like to thank our audience here and our audience listening at home. Our program tonight has been UNICEF CauseTech, Crowdsourcing Global Innovation for Good, with Dr. Sharad Sapra, Lisa Nash, Wayne Ferreira, and Donovan Neil May. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum, and I've been your host for tonight. I'd like to thank everyone here at the Commonwealth Club of California, everyone listening at home. And with that, our program is adjourned for tonight here at the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 125 years of enlightened public discussion.